Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
All righty then. Yeah, it's Monday and it's time for What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and welcome to 2019. This is the first show for my season. And I just want to say that this year kicks off our 10th year of broadcasting, of podcasting, I should say, for the Heritage Radio Network. And, you know, round of applause. Thank you very much. I've been here since the beginning, thanks to Patrick Martins, the founder of this station. And I have enjoyed every single moment of it. And I have learned more than I can possibly convey to you. Well, actually, I try to convey it every single week. And so, to that end, I'm having one of my very famous and favorite and also slightly famous, somewhat famous, guest Amanda Hitt. Amanda is the director of the Government Accountability Project's Food Integrity Campaign, which is also celebrating its 10th year. She oversees the Food Integrity Campaign operations and is responsible for ensuring that it fulfills its mission of enhancing food integrity by facilitating truth-telling. And in fact, their the email address there is whistleblower.org. So to do this, Amanda works closely with partner organizations, clients, legislators, and the media, that's me, to alter the and others, to alter the balance of power between the food industry and consumers. You can't imagine, especially right now, how very important Amanda Hitt's job is. And we're going to talk about that in a few minutes. But we're going to start the show, and I could go on and on about how many fantastic law degrees she has and all the incredible work Amanda has done, which I have to say puts somebody like me totally to shame. But the fact is that we don't have enough time for that, and you can always look it up. Go to Government Accountability Projects website, and you can look up Amanda and her extraordinary background. But in the meantime, she is going to join me now. Thank you, Amanda. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's so fun and so exciting to be back.
I know it's been it has been a long time, and I'm realizing that the first time you were on my show was probably about 8 years ago with Timothy Pacherat, who turned me on to you from his book Every 12 Seconds. He informed me about your presence and the Food Integrity Campaign, and then you became a semi-regular guest, and it's been a couple of years. So my apologies for not staying in the loop with you, but here we are, and we have much to talk about, and we will be talking about many things over the course of this next year, because as you and I were just saying off the air, one of the key points of the Reagan administration, of the Trump administration, is to Matt's my engineer is laughing at me. Yeah. Excuse me, I date myself with the Reagan administration and my outrage. But one of the key points to note about the Trump administration is when people say, well, he hasn't done anything that bad yet. Well, yeah, he has, because what he has done is, Amanda will correct me if I'm wrong in any way, but what he has done is roll back a lot of major regulations that we need to ensure our food safety. Why don't you give people a quick idea of some of the things that you guys have been working on, and then we'll talk about contract growing for the poultry industry.
Yeah, the list of rolled back regulations are myriad. I mean, there's too much for us to talk about today, but yeah. I can talk to you briefly about a couple of those regulations that we've been working on. We represent clients in the court of public opinion and, of course, the courts of law. So right. Some of the things I'll tell you about are sort of our policy end and what we're doing on the policy beat to keep some of these important regulations moving forward and not getting destroyed, and then what we're doing on the offensive to fight back. So what we're doing right. in court to sort of let the administration know that this isn't going to happen without a fight. And so one of the things that we are doing It's something called hemp, H-I-M-P.
Right.
Not H-E-M-P. H-E-M-P, everybody'd be tuning in, but H-I-M-P, everybody's wondering, what's that? So
yeah.
It's very, very basic level. You're speeding up the line speeds, the slaughter line speeds for, and what's happening now is poultry and pork, and you're right. reducing the level of inspection.
Right. And you and I talked about this years ago.
This is 15, 20 years. I mean, this is long before Trump. There was this idea that we could allow these meat industries to self-regulate.
Right.
And that's going to be great because that means less federal inspectors. You trim up the budget. And of course, you know, nobody needs these, you know, the meat industry is known for being wonderful self-regulators, meticulous and making sure that all of the I's are dotted and T's are crossed. Of course I'm being sarcastic. Of course that's not true. We know that from Upton Sinclair.
And really not much has changed, unfortunately.
Nothing has changed because the system only operates when the workers are exploited and underserved. And I know that, you know, say, oh, that's some crazy SWJ and talking about, you know. No, I'm really serious. Like, if you look at the meat industry, looking back at the jungle, looking back at that book, you see it today, you see it too.
You can't
have workers who speak, because if they could speak, they would tell you how awful it is.
Yeah.
And nobody would eat that meat, right?
Right.
So think about what I'm doing. As a whistleblower lawyer for food and agriculture, that's who I am. So foodwhistleblower.org, actually. So food whistleblower. So we go out and we try to give those people a voice. And when they speak, they say so much. And the reason I'm giving you that website is if you'd like to read what some of these people have to say about what's going on in the meat industry, we have for you all of the, I think over 20 affidavits that you can read from people, firsthand accounts of what's really happening with your food. Just to give you some perspective, all of those affidavits that are on our website are from pilot plants. So hemp hasn't gone through all the way in pork, and there's increased line speeds already in poultry now, but it hasn't gone through, and you can read what these folks have to say, the folks that are working in the pilot program. It's really astonishing, and this has been going on my end. Like you mentioned, I've been around 10 years, so probably about 4 of the last 10 years has just been on hemp.
Yeah.
Just fighting this fight to try to slow the speeds down. And I just want you to know, so you are it makes my food gross. It doesn't just make your food gross, it makes your environment suffer. The animals suffer more.
Yeah.
And of course the workers, it was horrible, musculoskeletal injuries,
right.
You know, like carpal tunnel and all chopped off hands and fingers. And I mean, it's not a lot has changed since the jungle. So, but fortunately for everyone, Donald Trump was elected and now we can look forward to this, every day when we eat our happy meals. We can be happy that we have chosen well, and we have deregulated the meat industry.
We've allowed the meat industry to run roughshod yet again. With the Food Safety Modernization Act, there was some effort to rein this in, and now it's just all holds are unbarred, as it were.
you know this. So Food Safety Modernization—that's FDA regulated food, right? So
yes.
They couldn't get to the meat industry. This is an extraordinarily powerful lobby, and I think. That I haven't taken up the entire show talking about hemp, but that kind of moves us into GPSA and the power of that lobby, and we see what happens there, right? So now we're looking at another regulation, this one designed to create some sense of equity between these monolithic giant food industries, which are all commingled seed / pesticide / I don't know if you, I'm just totally going off on a tangent, but I have to go there because I don't know if your listeners know this. Did you know that Blackwater, you know who Blackwater is?
Yes, I do. Eric Prince's, Betsy DeVos's brother's organization of mercenaries,
yes.
For people who don't know.
Yes, that's correct. Did you know that he's in the sustainable beef industry?
No, I did not. Oh, my God.
Isn't that something?
Isn't that weird?
Yes.
It's sort of counterintuitive. You'd think he'd be the one who's like, yeah, let's ramp up the industry here.
Well, I mean, I mean, it does give you pause, right? But it's called Blackwater beef.
Ew.
So, I mean, I guess you didn't want to eat that stuff. So,
right?
Like moving to a more sustainable model and away from this corporate stuff. But it makes it cheap. We need cheap protein to feed the masses and keep people sort of satiated and happy. But it's like, God, do we want to do this? Do we want to kill the environment, animals, and people, and all of the above? You know, to just keep the price of beef artificially low in the United States.
Beef, and poultry, and pork, all three of them are artificially depressed.
Pork. Yeah, the whole thing.
Yeah,
so.
No, it's really astonishing. Anyway, and, you know, as a complete aside to that, I am about to leave for Spain for a month.
Ooh.
And I have gotten myself in touch with some people who are organizing a movement in Spain to counter the rising tide of industrially produced pork. Because, you know, the Spaniards mm-hmm. are famous for their Iberico pork.
Yeah.
One of the things that I just learned from one of my contacts over there is that the Chinese have now contracted with several large pork producers in Spain, and they're ramping up their production exponentially, which obviously will have the same terrible impacts over there that it has over here. And of course, they're locating those CAFOs in, you know, rural and low-income communities, just the way they do here. They have no plans for how to manage their waste, just as they don't here. Yeah. I mean, it's you know, the American model, as I say in my book, which I'm bringing you a copy of, by the way.
Fantastic.
The American model has really penetrated deep into every corner of even countries where artisanally produced, you know, food products are a tradition and a way of life. And it's a sad thing to see. And I'm looking forward to learning more about their resistance and hoping to push that along for them as best I can, just by bringing some more light to it from other countries. But let's go back to the GPSA thing, because, you know, people's eyes glaze over. As we said, GPSA stands for Grain Inspection and Stockyards Act, which was enacted way back, I think, in the 30s or something. And it was under the Obama administration, it was theoretically going to be updated. And somehow those updates haven't really. First, they were watered down extensively. And then they didn't really take. But one of the things that they sought to regulate, and the subject of our conversation today, is regulating the contracts that exist between poultry integrators and poultry growers. So the poultry integrator would be like a Tyson, a Pilgrim's Pride, a Sanderson. And there's another company that I had never heard of,
Cook.
Which one is it?
You know, are you thinking of Cook?
Maybe.
Or Coke? K-O-C-H?
Yes, that's it. K-O-C-H. Yes, yes. I'd never heard of them before, which is kind of weird. But they don't obviously brand their – they have other names for those brands, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so you and I are talking about a case that has managed to wind its way through a process, and I'd like to know what that process is, in which a certain grower is successfully bringing a suit against another big poultry integrator. First of all, how did he get, you know, sort of from the complaint experience to actually getting a suit off the ground? Because, I mean, even just that in itself, I think, is probably quite a process.
Well, I guess I should say, as just a reminder, so we have two contract grower cases.
Yes.
One we brought under the aforementioned FSMA, FSMA, uh-huh. Food Safety Modernization Act. That was Craig Watts. You probably remember him.
But, yes, I do. Absolutely. I've spoken to him a number of times. Yeah.
He's a great guy. But that one, we're saying our general sort of statement there is that he blew the whistle on food safety issues.
Uh-huh.
And then he was retaliated against, and that violates FSMA. So that's how he got that. That process has to go through; it exhausts through the Department of Labor. So that's kind of a thing, you know.
Yeah, that's a big thing. Yeah.
Yeah, it just takes a while, and we're still there. And you know, we'll see. You know, we'll see where we are. Actually, it's going to come down to what Craig wants to do, because it's you know, years more of litigation
right.
on that case. But with Eric Hedricks. we filed that in federal court in West Virginia.
Uh-huh.
So that was not much of a process at all, and we are in these very early nascent stages. So I would say in this case we don't want to count our chickens.
Yeah.
Anyway, hopefully we'll get through to the point.
Good one, fantastic. Amanda.
I know. I thought it was good.
It almost went by me, but then I got it.
Okay.
The uptake there. Yeah. Maybe not so quick.
I've got a cough. Don't make me laugh.
Okay.
Anyway, I don't want to, you know, we're not in the end zone. It's no time to do the dance. Do the happy dance. We have to, we'll see where we go. And, you know, last time I talked to you, I didn't even talk about the, I think it's called the Terry case. And that just went up on appeal, and the appeal was denied, and it was a case on those very same Obama Fair Farmer Act
Fair Farmer Practices.
Yeah, there's two F's together. So I mean, it's tough. What differentiates Eric's case, Eric Hedrick? Why we feel? I think we're in a good place. For this case, I think I think he has a lot of things lined up. We looked long and hard before we took his case because I don't know if you know this, but suing people is hard,
yeah.
And expensive,
right?
And our clients don't pay. We don't charge them. So, and they not only don't charge, not even like cost or fee. So all of those things we have to shoulder right up front. Right from the beginning. So we went through quite a process before picking Eric's case to go forward.
But right.
I can only say, you know, it's in litigation now, so I can't get too deep in the weeds with you, but I can say that his has promise in a lot of dimensions rather than, you know, one big winner, right? He's got the whole panel of good things going for him that we look for in taking on a case. So we're optimistic. For your listeners who are like, well, what's this case all about? It's unfortunately very, it's very much a classic case, right?
Yes.
It's very much a, it's everything that I'm sure you've already covered on this show.
Well, we can always go back over it. In fact, I think it's best to just like the Fair Farmer Practices Act that we were talking about. Part of that act was meant to allow contract growers such as Eric to basically have some sort of transparency with the contract they're signing. And I wanted to ask you about that because in the complaint, it's referred to as a contract of adhesion. And of course, everybody wonders, like, if you're in the poultry business and you sign up with an integrator and you know what your contract is, then, you know, why are you complaining if everything doesn't go the way you want it to? Mm-hmm. So what I want to sort of cover in this show with you is the all of the many ways in which the contract is essentially stacked against anyone who gets into bed with a poultry or pork integrator, or even for that matter in the cattle business. It's a slightly different model, but it's still, you're basically at the mercy of these large companies. So can you talk a little bit about what a contract of adhesion is and sort of, you know, what how a contract grower essentially has, you know, his legs cut out from under him before he, you know, as soon as he signs the bottom line.
You know, the contract of adhesion concept is sort of that it's a take it or leave it. And I think for you to understand why one would take it at all,
yeah,
is you have to kind of understand the area's geography that these people are coming from. So let's talk about Eric Hedrick specifically.
Okay.
So he's in West Virginia.
Right.
West Virginia is not doing well economically. There are not a lot of jobs. Remember, dig, baby, dig, you know, like the whole, like
sure.
Anything you get, people were begging to have coal mining back.
Yes, they want the coal mining, yes, right.
That's how bad things are.
Yeah.
So the new coal mining in West Virginia is contract growing. So you take the same sort of, you know, people who don't have a chance, and then here comes the industry, these, you know, the fat cats, they've got everything going for them, and they say, I can make you rich if you go and get one of these very easy to get federally subsidized loans. Sounds like the housing of 2008.
Right.
It is, same thing, right? You go get one of those big fat loans out, and also make sure you just go ahead and you back that loan with your family farm.
Right. So you mortgage your farm,
you
essentially.
That's
right.
all you have. It's right. all your children will inherit. It's all you ever got, right?
Yeah.
You're just this West Virginia guy, or maybe you lady, but a lot of times it's gentlemen that do this.
Or a family.
Go ahead.
Right.
Or families. Yeah, the families. Like in Eric's case, it's a family farm. And same with Craig Watts, family farm.
Right.
So they do this, and they say in the industry, the companies promise you riches. Well, you know, like you say, well, you're a fool if you believe that. But this is the thing. I've seen this stuff that the company gives. It's very compelling, Katie. I'm an attorney. I think I'm pretty nuanced, and I wouldn't be duped. But, I mean, if someone said, well, you have all this land. Why don't you turn it into something profitable?
Right.
Why don't you make something happen? So they sell them these dreams. And then immediately sort of loop them into this rotating debt. And so by that, so they drop the initial million to get in, but right when they're almost breaking even and ready to pay off the farm, the company comes in and says, oh, you're going to need all new heating in the,
right.
or all new
all
ventilation.
New ventilation. Yeah.
Yeah. What's that going to be? $1 million.
Right.
Right? Or so maybe not a million, but a lot.
But a lot.
Back goes this cycle of debt. And so what happens is, it's like, I don't know, that's rural actually, but close to my rural home, suburban life, and you would see the same sort of awning on every little house.
Uh-huh.
And that's because somebody went through and sold those awnings, and your neighbor got the awning, and it just did that. And that's what you see in West Virginia. Somebody across the holler going to be rich with these, this chicken stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to do it. And the next guy does it, And you say, well, why don't they whisper down the telephone that it's a horrible
thing? That's not working out so well.
Well, here's what the company does, and this is what's so unbelievable that this happens in the United States in 2019.
Yeah.
The companies are so nefarious that they if they find out you've been talking about what's wrong with the system.
Yeah.
They actually retaliate against you.
Right.
So one of the things that you in these fair farmer practices that we were just discussing is to stop retaliating against people.
Right.
And also let them join groups of other growers. They can't even, it's not that they're trying to unionize. They just want to meet and find out what experience the other guy's having. But they can't do that in the current system because they're isolated. And that's kind of how that system works.
Well, talk about the tournament system, because that is one of the most, and of course, all of these companies absolutely deny that that is a factor. When Chris Leonard came out with the meat racket a few years ago, and it was about the Tyson company, and they stoutly denied, this is absolutely not the case. We do not do tournaments. You know, it's not, and tournaments are for, people who haven't read the meat racket or haven't listened to this show enough. Basically what happens is that these integrators, like the Tyson people, they rank the growers and they pit the growers against each other. But the growers are not, as Amanda, you just said, the growers are not allowed to speak to each other about the price per pound, for example, that they're getting, which is, I think, an absolutely shocking and shameful aspect of this. So these guys, am I right about that? The guys don't know how much money they're going to make per bird until they get weighed and taken away and weighed by the company. So they're not even present when that happens.
They're not even present, and they don't know when the tournament lists who's on top to bottom.
Yeah.
They only see themselves in the list. Everybody else is anonymous. So you can't even ask.
Wow.
How'd you do so well? Or what made you do so poorly?
Right.
Right.
Fascinating.
Isn't that interesting?
It's just the whole tournament thing. Let's back up for a second.
Okay.
We're going to take a quick break in a second, but I just want to ask this one question. Why is this profitable for companies to make these growers continually upgrade and go into debt? Like, is that a way of keeping them within their system? I'm sort of baffled by the perniciousness, the kind of basically evil quality of this experience for the grower. But I'm struggling to see why it's so successful for the integrators. What do you think is the motivation?
Well, I think that you know, and that's how they how it works, how math works.
How they control it, price-wise?
I don't know if it's a control. I don't know. Yeah, no, I mean, so the only, so they, this is this one area. So, yeah, she, your listeners know. So they own every single step from egg to omelet. Like, they own everything. So they own even where the little chickies grow, right, like come out, like, of the hatchery, right, and into the grower. The only problem they have is this middle guy that they have to pay to bird babysit.
Right.
And they don't see a person. They see an area that must be squoze, right? Squeeze it, squeeze it, squeeze it, squeeze it. And get that as
to maximize your profit.
Maximize it. Is it evil? I don't know if it's evil, but it is the way that you do it, is you squeeze that to a zero, like you want to, or as close to zero as possible. And that's how the machine works. And I don't think the machine has a lot of feeling or thought, certainly doesn't have any empathy. And it, and you'll see, you know, the industry fighting back, you know, we can't be profitable but for this exploitation. I mean, they're pretty honest about it.
Right.
Because you can't, none of this is, as it is, as much as it is not, it's not transparent to the average consumer, I don't think. They don't know this.
People have no idea.
They don't know about it. But as far as sort of operating in the light of day, they can't really deny what they're doing. I mean, it's pretty obvious, right?
Yeah.
And it's, what's interesting here, and what bothers me maybe most, and I don't know why, it bothers me more than, because the corporation is, you know, it operates on the profit motive. It doesn't have a soul. It's not going to sink, and it's not moral. But the government helps these in all kinds of ways, facilitates this wrongdoing upon the citizenry. And overwhelmingly, these citizens that are getting the hit, the getting hurt in all of this, are poor people.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, maybe some of them are doing okay. They're not doing great. You know what I mean?
Right.
And especially, you know, my friends in West Virginia who are being beat down on this. And it's not easy, you know, to feel sorry for these folks, I guess, because our inclination is like, well, you got a bad deal. But it's not a bad deal. It's a bad system, and they're a part of it. So that's a little different.
It is. All right, let's take a quick break for a sponsor drop, and we'll be right back with Amanda Hitt from the Government Accountability Project. Stay tuned for more.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit Corin.com.
So let's review some of the, I know what I want to talk about. I want to talk about in the complaint, I don't know if you're allowed to say anything about this, but there is an article in the complaint in which the company decides that the grower is going to, they instruct him to grow a lighter bird. Like, okay, so he's been told, up until now, he's been growing 4-pound birds. Suddenly they announce to him, we don't want 4-pound birds. We want 3.5-pound birds, because then we're going to inject enough water, which, by the way, is completely legal. We're going to inject enough water to bring it up to 4 pounds. But then that means that they can pay him less. Is that right?
That's right. Well, it's going to be a smaller bird, so his yield is going to be less, and it's going to be less efficient in the tournament system, so he's not going to do as well. I would like to point out, though, again, in case you didn't already know, and I think, Katie, you have let people know, the water that they're filling those birds up with, just FYI, in case you did not know, is shit water. So it's loaded up with fecal water.
Jesus, I did not know that.
Yeah.
Come
they
on.
Put in these big chillers. Yeah. So they lowered the weight and then fattened the birds with shit water.
Oh, my
and,
God.
And so, I know. So it's like, so when you're thinking, when you hear me talking to you about the gypsy stuff and you know, bad industry, it's actually much worse than you think. And you need regulation. You need your government stepping in. This is, we all eat. Like, we all have a stake in this, you know? We're not a stake. Nope.
You're killing me with the puns, girl.
I didn't even know I did that one that time. It came out. I can't even own it. It's like a pun fart. I just sort of let it out.
Man, you know,
that
you know, that's, you know, that is a really an extraordinary point because, like, let's go off on a tangent for a second about farmers. Like, most farmers that I've met, and usually those people are people who work in animal ag because that's my particular interest. Mm-hmm. They tend to be very conservative and they're Trump voters. And like when I had Mike Weaver from Organization for Competitive Markets on here, like, you know, last spring, you know, he was like, he voted for Trump and he said, you know, most of the guys that he knows voted for Trump and they'll probably vote for him again. Mm-hmm. And the reason behind that is because they really resent the regulations.
I know.
And it's like,
crazy.
You know, You're killing yourselves. You're shooting yourselves in the foot. I mean, they probably, I don't know whether they were upset when the Farmer Fair Practices, rules were gutted. That was actually during the Obama administration, but it was under when the Congress was solidly Republican. They were the ones who did that. So, you know, you're really voting against your own best interests, which is something that I see over and over again in the agricultural community. And I don't wish to, I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but at the same time, I find it absolutely astonishing and perplexing as these monopolies of businesses squeeze the life out of these guys, that they're not organizing themselves into some kind of a union that would fight back, that would generate money, that would help them win lawsuits. That, you know, it's the same thing in the dairy industry. There's no difference really between dairy and animal ag. I mean, they're just getting screwed by these big corporations.
It is, you know, I met a lot of growers, right? And I don't know any of them that aren't Republicans. They're all Republicans. And, you know, maybe not all, but I would say the vast majority. And I remember meeting with went out to a farm and the farmer was like, well, everything will be okay. Trump will take care of this. And I was like, well, I don't think so. But I was with two other lawyers and we were all got in the car and we were like, hey, where did that come from? Yeah. And we're like, it was like 4-hour drive home and we're all just sort of scratching our temples. Like, what is it about, I guess it's a history of ag. Voting that way, like it's a voter block, like it's just a culture of voting that way. I can't really.
It's like not wanting government in your business.
Maybe.
I mean, I really think it comes down to that.
And Americana I don't really think about things. I try to be nonpartisan and to the person who maybe just heard me talk for the first time, and clearly you're angry at Trump. You should know that I'm angry at everybody. If that's who's in office, and you're not going doing what I think you should be doing, and of course, you know, I'm an activist type, right?
Yes.
So at the time I meet these growers, and they're, you know, Republicans, and I'm, you know, I want to push things. I'm a rebel, right? Like I'm stealing fire from the gods. I'm bringing inside information and giving it to consumers with the help of brave whistleblowers. Bring this information to the masses, and we change the world. And we do it from the bottom up, ground up, grassroots. You know, in that way, and they don't really care. Like, they don't care. They just, you know, they don't see. They don't want to make a. You know, they're not trying to make a difference. They just want a fair deal.
They want a fair deal, but they don't want to work together to get it. And that's the thing that I find so so perplexing. I just don't. I mean, there's the Organization for Competitive Markets that Mike Weaver is in charge of. And there's a few other guys like him. There's, you know, Mike Calicrate, who's in the cattle business out in Colorado, has been. And then there's the whole ARC-HAF.
I'm in a coalition with them, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, they're small groups that don't seem to be able to attract as much support as you and I would think would be intuitive to them. And that's you know... That's just a very puzzling aspect of this whole thing. It's like,
where is their hero? I mean, Grassley's a hero in to some degree, but not compared to me. My observation. Look what Cory Booker's done.
Right.
You know, who's he?
Yeah.
I don't know. The biggest hero to contract growers. Also, like a potential. You know, let's be honest. He's a potential Democratic candidate. I mean, I think we all kind of know where this is headed. But
yeah.
Isn't that weird? I mean, he's done all of this this work to try to stop retaliation and protect the farmers.
Yeah.
And yet he's could not be more different from them as far as political ideology.
Yes, absolutely. Well, so let's move on here and talk a little bit about what could happen? Say these suits go forward, you know, well, they are going forward, but say you get a big win out of Eric Hedrick's suit. What kind of implications will that have for contract growers going forward? Does that seem like something that would change the, you know, level the playing field a little bit, to use a cliche?
Well, that's why a nonprofit. So, you know, I'm part of the Food Integrity Campaign at the Government Accountability Project, and what that's kind of our thrust is to bring consumers back on a eye to eye with the people selling them this food,
right.
These mega industries and Monsanto's and Bayer's and all the stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Litigation is a part of that. Through these whistleblowers, through these truth telling people, we're able to get information that levels the playing field. So you asked, does it level the playing field between the farmer and the industry?
Yeah.
Well, yes, right? Because if they levy some big verdict, you know, like that's going to change things. It's going to change that. But what more importantly, that's going to create the shift in knowledge and transference of that knowledge through whistleblowing, right? So through the inside and out. And then that's where the pressure has to, the pressure is going to start when the people start caring. Like, it just, that's just how it goes, because we change our whole culture of what's acceptable in the food industry has to change. And that's not going to change unless people know what's happening. So,
right.
I mean, yeah, of course, I think it will. And you should know, too, you know, we're not the only, certainly not the only game in town. There's a lot of, not a lot, but a handful of other other folks doing litigation right now, too. That's a good sign, right? Because the lawyers smell chum like sharks. Rah, rah, rah. There could be a win here, right? They wouldn't, none of these lawyers would pile on to losers, you know?
Yeah.
So something's happening. There's a shift, and there's blood in the water. And I don't know. I think we could see some changes through litigation. Unfortunately, litigation takes so long.
It
you know?
Does. But, you know, I think about, I mean, I think we should wrap it up here, but I just wanted to, you know, we were talking about a shift coming, and I was amazed that those North Carolinian communities prevailed against Murphy Brown, the subsidiary of Smithfield, in the nuisance lawsuit that they brought, and they got a big whopping judgment. Now, they may not see that money, but the fact is that they were awarded that judgment, and it's being appealed, obviously, by Smithfield, but nevertheless, yes, the judge was sympathetic for really the first time. I think this is the first time that an industrial player has been found accountable or guilty of. And I'm hoping that that's what will happen here with Mr. Hedrick's case.
Oh, I mean, one can only dream. But you have to understand, too, I mean, I'm sure you do, but everyone else listening, that a victory in court is doesn't have that immediate. There's the leveling there, but there's more to go, because in some of those articles, you would be surprised to know that instead of people high-fiving these poor people who have had poop sprayed all over them for years, are getting justice. The response is from the industry and from the communities that are not being affected, is that there is going to be a plague of lawsuits. The plague is the people who were injured. So that's what they think. So there is a that shows you, and I think this nuisance stuff and people, you know, being injured, you know, through fecal spray onto fields is very similar to what happens to these growers. Nobody wants to take responsibility, and no one wants to see those people prosper. I know it's going to sound weird to a lot of listeners, but that's how people feel about, you know, poor white Trump supporters, too. Yeah. Nobody really cares what happens to those people. And unfortunately, that's what you're hearing, of course, in North Carolina. There's a lot, as great as these victories are, we have to continue to soften the discourse around coming forward when you're hurt. You know, these marginalized folks need to be represented beyond just a win in court. We need to have that culture change I was talking about with farmers, too.
Yeah, I agree. Well, on that, I'm going to give you a moment to promote yourself shamelessly. Tell us all about where people can learn more about the Government Accountability Project and the Food Integrity Campaign, of which you are the director, and some of the information they can find on your site.
Well, thank you all for listening to me, and thank you, Katie, for inviting me back.
Let's do it again soon.
You can find me at foodwhistleblower.org. You can see that we have several different campaigns in different issue areas. I suspect if you're listening to this radio show, you are going to connect with at least one of those issue areas or campaigns. And I invite you to join us and become more involved with social media on Facebook and Twitter. But also, if you're interested, join our email list. We do not harass and harangue you. It's not a terrible thing. once a month, maybe, we'll send you an email letting you know what's going on.
Right.
And we will be letting you know about our 10-year anniversary.
Yes.
And the different events that we'll be hosting around town and maybe even in your neck of the woods. So,
That would be great, Amanda, because we're celebrating our 10th, too.
We should do something.
Do something together. I would love that. Yeah.
Can you talk to people at the conference or something? That'd be great.
Yes, I can make something live, like so that happen, going. I'm sure. I'm absolutely sure
of it. What if you, we were going to do a big conference. What if you just, interviewed people and maybe we could get a room for you and you could do interviews?
Yes, I did that for Nyman Ranch. I would love that. Okay, we'll talk about this off the air, but yes, let's make a plan. Folks, thanks very much for listening. Amanda, thank you so much for joining me today. And people, the next time you hear my voice, I will be speaking to you from sunny Madrid, which will be about the same temperature, but certainly a change of pace for me, and I think probably a fun change of pace for you. And thanks so much for listening today, and thanks to my sponsor. Did I say that already? Yeah, probably. And thank God Matt can edit that out. See you next week, folks.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.